Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Cop Talk podcast. I'm Steve Morielli from Boston. We're talking with thought leaders, change agents, leaders in police agencies, researchers, and criminal justice and community leaders about policing. I am absolutely happy to report that after just 5 or 6 weeks, we have reached 1,000 downloads. So thank you for listening. We're hearing from people in Ireland, Northern Ireland, in England, in 50 states so far. So thank you very much for listening. We appreciate it. Feel free to reach out and let us know how we're doing, what we can talk about, how we can help you. Today, you're about to listen to Angela Workman-Stark from Athabasca University. I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Workman-Stark, who was a retired chief superintendent after 24 years with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. We talked about leadership, diversity, women in law enforcement, and acceptance of others in the workplace and the state of policing in the world. So stay tuned for the upcoming interview with Angela Workman-Stark.
Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morielli and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Steve Morielli, and you're listening to the Cop Doc Podcast. I'm coming to you from Boston, and today I'm talking to Dr. Angela Workman-Stark, who is an associate dean at Athabasca University in Calgary, Canada. And we welcome her, and I would say thank you very much for being here, Angela. Please introduce yourself to the audience.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Steve. I think I was like a little kid on Christmas morning this morning, thinking about all the good topics that we can speak about this morning, because we've talked about a lot of them over the years. I'll just give a little bit of background. So before I stepped into my second career as an academic, I spent a little more than 24 years in policing, specifically with the Mounties, Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And like most officers, I started out in uniform patrol functions, did that for a few years, and had a really great opportunity to move into one of our specialized functions at the time, which was called Proceeds of Crime Money Laundering Investigations. Really enjoyed that. Did some great work, worked with some great people. Had an opportunity to do some undercover work as well around that time in different types of investigations, not just money laundering. And also what was a key part of that point in my career is I started taking courses towards my Master's of Business Administration degree, which really started to open my mind towards things beyond our sort of frontline operations, but also around things about leadership and culture and change and strategy. So I guess you could think about it in a sense of those sort of back office type themes that really directed how the front office or the frontline policing services function. And then a funny story, actually, I was thinking about this last night. It was, I was doing some undercover work and I happened to be in this fortified building meeting with one of our targets, and knowing that there's a very thick door between me and anybody getting in should something go wrong. And having this conversation for a period of time, I was in there as an undercover management consultant and thinking, what a really neat business model this guy has in place for his operation. But that's really where my thinking started to turn to. And as I progressed through my career, that's where the focus was. Quite frankly, I thought the operational side was in great hands. We did it well. I can say that not about the Mounties, but a lot of other policing services. When things go wrong, we generally do a very good job with that. And where I thought my attention could be better directed was in some of these areas that I don't think we did so well. And so that was the career path I took. What brought me to academics, when I started to realize that this is the focus that I wanted to be involved in. I wanted to be a part of really addressing these complex themes. I knew that I needed a bit more tools, and that's where you and I met, I think probably about 16 years ago now, when I found Walden University and started taking my PhD. But fast forward a few years, and the roles I took on were really about sort of restructuring, restoring trust, leadership development type aspects, working to enhance the professional development of our officers, actually doing some instruction with our executive leadership cadres. And one of my final roles, and this is sort of what's the catalyst for me leaving policing and moving into an academic role, is at one point in time, almost a decade ago, we had a number of women come forward quite publicly, our police officers at the time, that were sharing with media, they were sharing stories of discrimination, harassment, sexual harassment, even sexual assault. And I suspect that along with myself, thousands of our colleagues were really sort of captured by these narratives that were coming out. A short time after that, there's a class action lawsuit, about $100 million class action lawsuit that was launched. And the commissioner approached me asking if I'd be willing to oversee the organization's response to those allegations. So really look at how do we create a much more inclusive workplace? How do we address these issues? And so because I had obviously different types of experience, one thing I wanted to do was to spend time listening to these stories. So having conversations with my peers across the country and to listen to the narratives that they shared about their work experiences. And I had a conversation with a young woman, and this is something that has stayed with me, will continue to stay with me. But her story was just so tragic that I couldn't sleep for 3 weeks. Really, I thought about it and I would hear more stories. And it wasn't just from women, it was about men, but also it was about men that were suffering from post-traumatic stress, really worried about the ramifications for their career, for their relationships with their peers, if they came forward. And so these are the stories that I internalized. And after a period of time, obviously there was an impact on myself mentally for really, you know, listening to so many narratives. And this is not to say that there weren't some great stories as well about the amazing men and women and the work that they did every day and continue to do that. But these are really serious and heart-wrenching stories that were shared. And at a point in time, I realized that our culture and our context at that point in time wasn't conducive to addressing these complex issues. And as you know from your background, you know, law enforcement were very tactical. And we can do things tactically and do them well. But when it comes to complex issues and you're asking questions about culture and why do those things occur, we weren't doing that. I wasn't satisfied that I could do the things that I needed to do to really help address these questions. You know, at that time,
from the inside. Yeah.
I was, you know, chief superintendent, I was a senior executive, and I felt really frustrated with myself, a sense of guilt, a sense of duty to these people who had heard their stories. So I made the decision. There was a great opportunity opening up in Athabasca University to join the Faculty of Business, teaching in the Department of Organizational Analysis. So I made that leap to academics, really so I could focus on these questions and asking these tough questions to learn more about what are some of those internal dynamics that help create harmful experiences for men and women, which translates, quite frankly, into the relationships we have with our communities? So that's kind of a bit of a narrative. What brought me here and my focus on really, you know, good relationships with our communities starts from the inside.
Very interesting. What you're saying, too, is sometimes it seems you became frustrated. So you went on a listening tour within the RCMP, right?
Yes.
But I presume that there was a little reluctance at first to talk to somebody who was in uniform and who was a chief superintendent. So that must have been maybe not difficult, but you had to show and prove that you were willing to listen and you were not here to slap, but to listen and see if you could make some difference.
Absolutely, 100%. And it was at a time, and I mean, this is not unique to the RCMP, but there certainly was a lack of trust between sort of the frontline officers and leadership. So that was a factor. I was coming from Ottawa, which was national headquarters. So that was another factor. So I had to find ways to connect with people either through relations that I had previously, but had to work really hard so that they saw me as someone that they could entrust with their narrative, and then I would do them no harm. And that's the approach that I took, and it really opened up. You know, from one conversation went to the next, and those conversations continued to expand over a period of several months.
So in essence, you were doing some, whether you realized or not, some research, and that, right, by asking and pulling and plugging and basically listening. My question would be, from the RCMP's point of view, was that accepted? Were you able to sort of synthesize that those things you were finding to find common threads and common themes to try to create an opportunity for change of culture?
I'd say yes and no. Certain of my senior leadership peers, that absolutely this is something that they wanted to learn more about. But I think on the other side, and I think in fairness to the organization, there was so much pressure. It's the National Police Force. It's the Mounties, right? They're renowned. They're known around the world. And there was so much pressure. And it was like living in a bit of a fishbowl with various groups, various entities, whether they're sponsored from a parliamentary committee or what have you, were looking at the organization. And I think, quite frankly, for the commissioner at the time, he really just wanted to, let's move forward. We have some action items. Let's just get them done and move forward, so that we can prove that we're addressing this. We've got so many other fires to put out. And that really was, right? It was much more of a tactical response, which I knew was really only going to be a compliance-centered sort of approach where we would say, you know, we report back to government and say, tick, we completed all these initiatives. Look, it's great. So I had to take into consideration the context, but it really was not right to dig into these really tough, challenging issues, because it would mean exposing certain things about ourselves, and me included, from spending 24 plus years in the organization.
Mm-hmm. So as I'm hearing you, you wrote a book. And so talk about that a little bit and what the genesis of that book was, and if it has impact
or you hope it has impact in organizations nationwide in Canada and perhaps beyond?
Yes. So it's interesting. I never even thought I'd write a book that so obviously came out in the spring of 2017, and it's titled Inclusive Policing from the Inside Out. And I knew from experiences, to your point, when you're listening to people and you're conducting interviews, you're doing research. And I knew from those experiences and the stories that I heard, these really powerful, compelling stories, that I had to share this. And because when I was in my role, you know, we're struggling. And you know this from your own experiences, when you're reaching out, who's done that, right? Who's done this? And we all know that any type of change is really difficult, let alone cultural change. And so I would look around to different agencies, Australia, New Zealand, et cetera, the US, there was nothing. And so I felt compelled that at least I should put together a book that would give a bit of background to some of these themes around organizational justice, which we really preach in terms of procedural justice with communities and those relationships, but not so much on the inside. And so it was really putting together a bit of a background to understanding policing, the culture, issues around identity, justice, why there's barriers to inclusion. And the second half of the book was really digging into what are some things that could be done to change that. So it was meant to be helpful to organizations. I think it has been helpful. I know I've spent quite a bit of time in Australia since I retired, working with some of the services. I know they've utilized the book. I know it's been utilized in Canada. And there's certainly a lot more I would add to that now. I mean, there's a lot more I understand since then. But that was really the genesis of it. To be honest, it was cathartic as well, in terms of I'm open, I share my own narratives in there, how I looked at other officers probably a little bit differently because I didn't perceive them to be masculine enough. You know, they were maybe a bit too feminine. So, I mean, I was really open and shared that, and, you know, issues around identity and the parts of yourself that you leave at the door when you come to work because of the pressures to be a certain way. So that's really what it was about. I hope it's helped.
So you say procedural justice, just a shift from the inclusivity to procedural justice in the way organizations, especially policing organizations, are hoped to interact with communities. But as much as you were talking about inclusivity inside, and you say inside and out, it seems to me that there's that same issue that certainly what we're seeing in the United States with Black Lives Matter and with what just happened at our Capitol, that there are people who see the world through different colored glasses, and the police are stuck in the middle. And so from your point of view, so let's go back to leadership. So you're sitting with a class, maybe with some executives. What are the questions that you pose to get them to think, about how they can have an impact on their agency and the community?
So some of those conversations, and I have spent some time certainly with some executive teams in just having a conversation about, you know, trying to unpack some of these issues, and generally start out with a conversation asking them, what are they hoping to do? Right? What are they hoping to do in terms of their organization and its mandate and its missions? And how do they hope to do that? And then it's getting into conversation, but then it's what's getting in the way, right? What's getting in the way? And there's a lot of things that come up. And it generally gets to, we do come to this topic around procedural justice. It comes from the perspective that what I share from my experience and from the research, and there's been some good research in the US and the UK, that illustrates that some of those things that we're seeing happening on the outside, some of those really unfortunate events of excessive use of force, et cetera, we're seeing a correlation in many cases with how people are treated on the inside with what's happening on the outside. So this is where some of the conversation comes about that I have with them. And it's asking these questions around what's getting in the way. And they'll talk about behaviors and disciplines and leadership challenges. At the end of the day, you know, it really is at that sort of top executive cadre that really starts to set the direction and strategy for the organization, and how they emulate leadership and the types of leadership behaviors that they value really sets the tone for the organization. So those are the really tough questions and conversations that we tend to have.
So think back to as you were climbing the ladder in the RCMP, and you're a new leader, you're a woman. I would say that you'd have to explain to the audience and to me how many women make up or are members of the RCMP. But as a woman climbing the ladder, what kinds of mistakes do you recall making as a new leader?
That's an easy one to answer, which is probably shouldn't be a good response, but it is. So I'm just going to go back a bit. And these are things, again, I didn't think about them at the time. They started to emerge later as I really, right? I took a step back and looked at things again from the inside out. I knew at an early point in my career that there weren't a lot of women around. If women made a mistake, it was really deemed to be, well, there's an example. Women shot to not be allowed in policing. And so I joined in 1992, and there's a decision made in 1974 to first permit women to join the RCMP and be police officers. So we're not talking a ton of years in between those two points in time. But I knew early on that if I really wanted to be successful and not be perceived as one of the others, I need to limit my interaction with women. And that's, you know, that's a mistake right from the get-go. I lost out on some of those really powerful friendships and connections with women. But when I stepped into a leadership role, I think I felt that, again, I was always having to prove myself. I really having to prove myself that I was competent enough. And the first mistake I made was, overseeing a recruitment function in Central Canada, Ontario, and Quebec. I was responsible for our recruiting police officers. We were having a really tough time because we didn't have contracts. We didn't have visibility in Ontario and Quebec in terms of being in uniform. So we're competing with all these other police services. And so I was really responsible for a restructuring. And, you know, I thought at that point in time, I've got an MBA under my belt. I'm doing my PhD. I know what I'm talking about. And I had built some really great relationships with the people I was working with. But the mistake I made at that point is thinking that I had all the answers. And so I determined what the new structure would look like. And I implemented this new structure. And then I announced the structure to everybody. So they've been working for a period of time a certain way, well before I arrived on the scene. And that was really hard. And those first discussions I had with them to explain this is where I wanted to go, it was like, right? I realized I had made a serious misstep. And so I had to spend a lot of time restoring that trust and then allowing them to be part of it. But it was perhaps the arrogance, this pressure I had on myself to prove myself over and above anybody else, only over and above my male colleagues, that I could be successful. That I did probably the worst thing that I've always complained about, is just not being able to influence, change yourself. And I didn't bring the people along with. So that was a tough lesson learned in terms of a new leader in an executive role.
So you're talking about missing the opportunity to engage and to get feedback from them that would have made perhaps a stronger decision that you would make. You did it unilaterally.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. And that's understandable. I think we all make those kinds of mistakes. So here's the other question. As you began to be somewhat more inclusive, sometimes when you walk into a police organization, the boss, more autocratic, that's what we were used to, and that we're just going to wait to be told what to do because they don't want our input. So that when you walk into an organization where you're now asking for input where no one had ever asked, how do you break those barriers down? How do you say to people, we really want you to contribute? We really need your eyes on the ground, in other words, but you understand. So at what point in time did you have some trouble sometimes saying, listen, I don't want you to be, it's like passive learning versus active learning. When you're in the classroom, I want you to contribute. When you're in the meeting, I want you to contribute. I just don't want you to be here to listen.
So when I left the RCMP, and actually I did some consulting work with some police services in Central Canada. And so, you know, the benefit of, you know, sort of social media and having an online presence is people, they'll check you out. And so before I would meet with any officers, they already knew my background, my pedigree, what I did, what I thought, where I had been a little bit vocal about sort of certain things I thought around leadership, etc. So that was always a good door opener. But what I found really challenging, Steve, was, and it's not that so much that people didn't want to talk, but their feedback was always around, yeah, but no one will do anything. We've done this before and no one will do anything. The same old thing. You're going to listen to us. I'm going to spend an hour of my time talking to you and that'll be great. We'll have a nice conversation, but nothing will change. And so that was the most difficult thing, because there, as you know, when you go into an organization, you can't control any of that. All you can do is have some great conversations, make some recommendations, and hopefully there's some action taken. That was the most difficult thing. It wasn't that people aren't willing to sit down with me. It was just the fear that nothing would change or no one would listen because that's what they were used to in the past.
That's interesting. Let's go back again to about leadership, because leadership is about people. Leadership, in my mind, is about relationships.
Yes.
And establishing relationships. And so as you're teaching, as you've learned, I'd like you to speak to what you think are some of the elements of leadership. What does it take to get involved in leading, to encourage change, to engage others? What are the skills? What are the skills that come with being a good leader?
Yes, I think I'll take it back to certainly my philosophy on this, and I'm not the only one, is this leadership is not a position, it's a process. And it's a process of relational influence. So obviously to be able to do that, leaders have to have the ability to create really strong collaborative relationships with people and be able to work laterally, right? And not so much in a directive, authoritative type of manner. And I think one of the most critical characteristics or trait of a leader is being able to listen to understand. And from policing, as you indicated earlier, a lot of that is the expectation that leaders are the all-knowing, all-powerful type people. But that's changed. And that's changed with policing. And it's being able to listen to people, be able to provide some strategic direction based on what you've heard, to be able to set a vision, and then give people the tools that they need and get out of the way that let them do their work. And that was always my philosophy. We got amazing men and women around us. You know, help set some direction, get them what they need. And for the love of God, get out of the way and not micromanage them and feel this need to be checking on them all the time. I mean, that's a really important aspect of leadership. And I see some police leaders doing a great job and others that are, they're reverting back to what we've known for a long time in policing. And I don't know why. I don't know why that is in terms of their expectations. But those are, there's some very, very basic considerations around a leadership.
What do you think are three issues policing should be focused on today?
Yeah, so I'd say a big one, and I've had some really interesting conversations around this theme lately. I think a big one is to really look deeply internally. I'm convinced, Steve, that, you know, so the issues that I saw in the Mounties are not unique to the Mounties, and they're not unique to Canada. They're not unique to Australia. These issues around, in terms of how we interact with people, the behaviors that we seem to value and endorse or tolerate, we're going to find them in many police organizations. And I think that's a really key piece for police leaders to look inside and look inside at the type of leadership behaviors that you value, the type of people that you select. Do we go to the tactical kind of group quite a bit in terms of value that type of sort of operational experience? But I think that's critical. And I think we really have to look at in terms of how we lead, how we look at aspects of just, that's critical. And I think we're going to continue to have these same challenges until we really start to understand that the men and women in policing deserve to have that same level of justice that they're expected to deliver with others on the outside. So really start, I think that's fundamental. Other issues that we're talking about in terms of aspects of use of force and some of those are tactical things. And I think those will become resolved, but it really starts at how do we want to interact with the men and women in our organization? How do we expect them to interact with each other? And what values we want them to embrace and that we promote and that we assess and that we provide feedback on a consistent basis? I think that's a key one. The other aspect of that, I think with policing, so this becomes sort of the outside part of this, is to really look at, I think what I've seen from my research, the interviews that I'm doing lately, Steve, is I think the us and them has really expanded, and it's really expanded. And, you know, the more criticism there is against the police, the more that relationship seems to deteriorate. I think it's going to be a really key focus for, you know, policing is to really sit back and listen to some of those conversations, even if, you know, we don't like to hear what's said, but really listen to those conversations. And I also think this is not just on the police. So the third thing, it's not just on the police, but I think we really have to set back as a society and say, what do we expect our police to do in 2021 and going forward? Is it the same that we've done for all these years? So those kind of like the, you know, the big bucket of three things.
Yeah, I mean, because what you're talking about is mission creep, you know, and that things that we have taken on, and is that too much? You know, we get in trouble for walking into cases that should be moved along, the whole defunding discussion that's going on, more social work, the mental health aspect. But what you just said, and I think, and this is a common theme among some of the interviews, is that we have to worry about how we treat each other and how we treat police officers in their workplace, or else they're going to mistreat people when they go outside. And so, and in so many situations, you'll find that police officers would much rather deal with people they don't know on the outside than the treachery that sometimes happens on the inside. Fair statement?
Yes. And so look at all the research that will say the stressors emerge from the work environment, not from the work itself. And I'm talking about the internal working environment. So there's all kinds of evidence to say that's the case, right? Mm-hmm. It's an important focus.
Well, one of the things too that's coming up, and that has to do with mental health or wellness, which we're hearing a lot of. But in terms of mental health, the mental health of our police officers and what they encounter, the stressors that they, the things that they see, we're called into some of the most difficult situations in life. And yet how many times have you heard, well, that's what you're paid to do, you know, so suck it up, buttercup, or whatever somebody would say. But are we at the point, how do we change the culture to say, after an event happens, we really should debrief to make sure that the person who encountered that is okay to continue the work? The fear is of police. If I say I've got a problem, they're going to take my gun away. I mean, that's a pretty difficult situation to overcome.
But you know what? Honestly, Steve, that's on the police leader. It really is. That is on the police leaders to make it be okay that people can come for without repercussion. And so it's not just about taking their gun. And I remember some of the conversations that I had, you know, a number of years ago was from our tactical. So from our emergency response, or you might call SWAT sort of in the US, was that real fear. I can't tell anybody. I can't tell anybody because I'll lose this coveted job and I'll be one of those others. And so that's on police leaders to really work through this crap, if I might say, that if you ask for help, that you're weak and you're not a real man. You're not manly enough to do this type of work. That's the part I think that's really causing so much harm in law enforcement today. I really do. But that is on the leaders to really start to change that culture, start to be the ones themselves to come forward. I struggle struggled, I'm struggling. They need to set the examples and really make it okay that people can come forward without feeling that they're going to face repercussions career-wise or just in the relationships with the people that they work with.
One of the things that I heard you say, there were two words that you've used, and I think reflection and listening, in my mind, are two things that we don't get the opportunity to do enough of. But how important it is for leaders to take the time to step back and reflect and to learn how to listen? What's your take?
You know, I can't emphasize it enough. There's one person I think you had an opportunity to speak to, Andrew Colvin, is a former commissioner of Australian Federal Police. And when they went through a similar challenge to the Mounties in 2016, it really came out the same type of stories. One of the things I loved what they did is they had people who had these really negative, horrific experiences in the organization share their stories with the senior executives. So they made it a point, and it was not to judge. It was not to, this was not an investigation. We were not validating. We're just going to listen to your story to understand your experiences. Powerful, absolutely powerful thing that he did. And I know from talking to some of those deputy commissioners, et cetera, after they were very emotional about it. They didn't, right? For various reasons, they didn't understand it. So I think it's a really critical point to have those types of opportunities to listen, to hear the narratives from people in terms of how they experience the workplace, and to reflect on that, what it means for individuals as leaders in their leadership roles and what they need to do differently to change those experiences.
So while you were at the RCMP, I remember towards the end of the career, you were doing some traveling, and one place was to Australia. Where else did you go where you were collecting information and trying to understand what one unit was doing that you may be able to bring back to use with the RCMP?
So I spent, my work took me through to Israel. I spent time in Israel as well, which is an interesting place, but it's just some of the relations that they had in place there. Australia, New Zealand, I hadn't, like Israel, just looking at some of the things. Northern Ireland, I had a really good opportunity to spend some time in Northern Ireland in terms of learning how they're going about different types of change. So it wasn't necessarily about the same themes, but it was the leadership of models around that, the transformational models around that. And in some cases, I looked to private sector as well and really understanding so their approaches and process they'd taken. And so I spent some time down the US, down in Florida, et cetera. But I mean, a lot of it was, and certainly in the UK, talking to other police services. It was, but again, at the time, as I indicated, Steve, you know, it was reaching out. I couldn't find a playbook. I couldn't find a playbook like, to help us work through that. And that was the most frustrating thing, is not having the answer. And your people, you know, because the people were looking up to the senior people in the organization saying, but you need to solve this. And quite frankly, why would we have the answer, right? Why would we? Police aren't trained to focus on some of these complex issues. Great tactician, great in setting in place some strategies. But I think that was the really frustrating point. I couldn't find the pieces that I really wanted to focus on and help us do what we needed to do.
So you just said that at times you would go outside into the private sector and try to gain some information and input on how they addressed some of the issues. That
yes.
Being said, what are you reading? Where do you find ideas? What do you read? Are you reading police literature? Or are you reading business literature, or a combination of both?
I read everything. A lot in policing, but again, you know, it's, you know, sometimes we get stuck in our own environment too much and you know, I sit back and reflect enough. So I look at policing, business, philosophy. I listen to podcasts. I watch TED Talks. I like to listen and learn about the different perspectives that people hold across, you know, very multidisciplinary type areas. I think it's really helpful. I listen to people I don't even agree with just to understand how they're thinking about. And I think that's really critical. You really need to do that and not to have sort of these polar opposites, but just to listen. So anything, and listening to some of your, reading some of your stuff, Steve, and you know, watching what you do and reading what you do when you spent some time over in Ireland yourself. And I think you're still there. But it's just, you know, I'd like to learn from the experiences of people, because I think that's really helpful just to sort of top up our toolbox, if you will, and the things that we can do to continue to assist organizations.
Well, you're a lifelong learner, and I think you have curiosity. And I think those who can be good leaders have to be in a constant state of learning and willingness to learn, in my mind. What's on your to-do list? What's something you haven't been able to get to, but it's on your to-do list? Are you looking at it?
I have, you know what, it's funny, and I don't want point it happened, but something happened. I think I was, you know, thrown into the time machine and thrown back out half-baked or something. But I have this incredible curiosity to ask questions about different types of things. And so a lot of my to-do lists are about research projects. So it's not about, you know, any great trips or something. It is about research projects. And to really delve into, for one of them, just very briefly, is I'm looking into the sort of the aspect of dirty work, you know, and stigmatized occupations. occupations and how policing falls into that realm. I'm looking at why people might resist diversity in organization. What are some of those contextual factors that either amplify that or might moderate it? So it's really around different types of research projects. I want to have some great collaborations in place with police organizations and similar constructed organizations with similar cultures. Like, it's just, you know, it's a long list of things that are, I think there's an infinite list of questions to be answered just to continue to think about how can policing be a contributor to sustainable societies over time. And I think those are some of my questions that I really want to explore, and hopefully I get to a good chunk of them before I'm done doing what I'm doing.
If you had a chance to talk to somebody either alive or dead, who would you want to pick their brain? Somebody with notoriety, somebody famous, or somebody who has been influential?
You know, it's funny. So there's two people that come to mind, and one is Colin Powell. I think if I'm pronouncing correctly, Colin Powell. And I remember only because I had an opportunity to do some security work when he visited Canada with George Bush back in 2003, I think. And a lot of the material that was coming about around his thoughts around leadership. And I think it's somebody I would just, because of his experiences, his perspectives, I would like to sort of sit down with him. And the other person who's obviously deceased, I would love to have had a conversation with Nelson Mandela, just, you know, in terms of just from the perspective of resilience and purpose and mission and belief, I'd be fascinated. So certainly that's the second person in a perfect world.
That's great. That's a new, I imagine being put in jail for as long as he was, and to come out and to be such a leader and have faith and
forgiving.
Forgiveness is the big one. What podcast do you listen to? You said you are listening to some. What are they focused on? What draws your attention?
So interesting enough, I like to listen to controversial people. And so some of them, you know, works of say Jordan Peterson, for instance. And so here's someone, right, that's quite vilified. And it's not that I agree with things that he says. It's if there's a certain, and this comes from my stepson, you know, he's 25, he's a paramedic down in Ottawa. You know, he's kind of a little bit more conservative values, but I like to listen to things that he's talking about. So he'll listen to, and I think what's his other name? Rogan. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Joe Rogan.
And so some of those things, podcast interests of people that might be, you know, again, might be a bit controversial, but I'm curious to what people of my stepson's generation are saying and thinking. And so I just want to listen to the other perspective because it's interesting. Instead of, I'm fearful, Steve, and I'm probably not the only one, that we've started to shut down voices that we don't agree with. And whether that's, you know, left or right, which I really hate that we're saying that now, but I think we're really shutting down voices, and we just should be opening to listening, because the more we listen to different types of voices with the intellect that we have, we can sort of filter through them, you know, and make some judgments about what we hear and what that means. So I'm leaning a little bit more to that.
Well, is that helping in your teaching? Obviously, you've got some non-traditional students, meaning they're not the 20-year-olds or 18, 20-year-olds that you're teaching. But are you seeing that in your classes?
One of the courses that I have actually, which is, it comes from all my work, and it's called Managing Diversity for Organizational Sustainability. And in that class, and again, this is all virtual online, so people are distributed, but I really promote that this is a space for respect, listening, understanding. We value all perspectives. And I'm really careful that even some of the, you know, some of the really, I think, negative commentary around if you're a white privileged male, I don't let that become a part of the conversations. And so I look at that everybody should come from a place of curiosity. You're in this course because you want to, you know, to learn something, to better understand some of these complex, really sensitive issues. So I promote that this has to be a space where we're learning to different points of view, and I bring that in. And we talk about some of these people that Jordan Peterson, for instance, in terms of his take on some of these issues around diversity and pronouns, et cetera. We talk about individuals like that. They have the space to say what they think. And so I really promote that we have to be open and welcoming to other points of view, even if we just despise what the person says. Because if we shut that down, I don't think we grow to the extent that we need to do. So it's why I do it, right? If I'm going to tell people to be listening to things they don't agree with, I make a point of listening to understand people on the other side of the table from me, to say, really just to consider where they're coming from. You know, the idea of almost like interspace negotiation around the issue, if you will.
Well, and that's going to be important in policing, because you have to know who you're policing. And when you're walking into a different community that you don't know, sitting and listening could be, first of all, it's not the first thing police do, but it is, yes, an important element of what they should do. Let's close by asking you this question. I like to work in groups of threes. You can do two, three, four. What are your personal values? What do you hold true?
So one, it's people. And you think, how's that a value? But it's a people. I value people. People and their best interests, and being a part of helping people grow, et cetera. So that's a really important value, just people. right? I really invest in people. It's why I love leadership roles, why I do what I do now. I think I value integrity. It's critical, right? And when we start to sort of move from that past, I think that's really detrimental. So those are people, integrity and trust. I think those are the big ones for me, and, you know, front and center, because without those, all the other really values that are important, you know, that aren't going to be really prevalent and prominent as they should be. So yeah, kind of people front and center. And again, around those core values of trust and integrity, I would say.
Terrific. Well, we have to shut down, close down. I want to thank you. Thank you very much for joining me, Angela. I appreciate it. It's great to see how successful you've become and the voice that you have, and keep plugging. That's for sure. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. And just before we sign off, you were a big part of that, if you recall. So you were a part of shaping my journey, and I thank you for that. And thank you for the invitation this morning.
It's my pleasure. So this is Steve Morielli, and you've been listening to the Cop Doc podcast, and I am happy to say farewell and thank Dr. Angela Workman-Stark from Athabasca University in Calgary. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to Angela Workman-Stark. Appreciate all of her input and her thoughts and her perspectives on policing, on teaching, on leadership, on diversity. Remember, this podcast is intended for criminal justice students, faculty members, practitioners. Many who are interested in policing are also welcome. And we honor the men and women in the field, those who put the work in to protect our cities and towns, highways and airports 24/7. Stay safe, and thanks for what you do.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc podcast with Dr. Steve Morielli. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.